Okay, let's start. A quick question before we start, which may influence the course of this lecture a little bit. How's the pace of these lectures going so far? Basically, okay. How many people think? It's maybe a bit difficult to ask this question because kind of you don't want to say, but in general, how many people think they're too fast? Too many of you. How many people think they're too slow? And how many people think they're broadly okay? Broadly okay, including the last one I gave, which was a little bit faster than that was okay too. Broadly so. Okay. And the reason why I ask is because in this one I kind of have a choice, and it's actually a slightly more difficult choice because I have another kind of pair of things that I want to talk about, and one is to do with design, and another one is to do with the limits of finite state machines. And I'm kind of half inclined to run them both into one lecture, but we'll see how we go. If it's feeling that it's going to be a little bit too much to squeeze in, it is a bit of a change in context, then I'll maybe just do this first bit. If it feels like we can do the rest, then we'll go on and do the other bit. What that does is it buys you another lecture. My whole plan with these lectures, by the way, is to get through the basic material, and then towards the end, once I've got through that, which, depending on how quickly I go, will be sooner or later, then I'll do a series of lectures at the end that are rather more broad across informatics. So those are the bits that I consider those to be the ones that are my luxuries that I give to, just to talk about things that I think you will generally find interesting, still technical, but interesting, rather than things that are kind of nuts and bolts that you must know because that's what you need to know foundationally for the rest of your time here. So that's kind of the trade-off I'm playing against. Anyway, let's onto this thing. So what I want to talk about in this particular lecture, or possibly the first half of the lecture, depending on how we go, is about a little bit about designing larger systems, because I think it's nice for you to think about that. And the reason why I think I might be able to go through this faster than usual is because last time we went through a bit of design of a fairly simple one. I'm hoping that a lot of you had a chance to think about that a bit between then and now. But before we get on to using transducer finite state machines, remember the transducers are the ones that have input-output on the links, I want to talk a little bit about software life cycles. I don't know how many of you may have had some exposure to people talking about software life cycles before. How many of you have had people talking about, it's not that many, I'm expecting just a few, but most of you will have had no exposure to that whatsoever, which is completely, that's completely fine. I just wanted to make sure that it wasn't some, suddenly they were teaching this at school or something, but they're not. In industry, I'm guessing the ones that put up their hands either have somehow done some work connected to something industrial or have been close to that or were interested in that somehow, because usually that's where these things crop up. Let me spend a little bit of time going through this, because in the software engineering world, this is an important thing. And the reason why software life cycles are an important thing, and the reason why there's an entire segment of the industry concerned with this, and a segment of academia actually considered with the study of software life cycles, is because the early stages of a software life cycle, the bits where you talk about the requirements for your software, same for other systems actually, but software especially, is normally the place that costs you the most. If you make an error in the early requirements of your system, a fundamental error, sometimes not so fundamental, but one that persists and is very difficult to get out of your requirements process, then that error costs proportionally an awful lot more than something that's introduced much later. Its effects tend to persist and they tend to permeate everything else. So then people who are designing software for real, where you might have something that's fairly complex, it's not just some little thing that you're building for an academic purposes and you only need to worry whether you can use it, you need to worry whether your clients can use it, worry a lot about these sorts of things. Here's one standard model. There are many, many, many models of software life cycles, and a huge amount of discussion about which is best in which context, and there's no way that we're going to be getting into that in this lecture series. You get aspects of that later in your time at the university if you continue to do informatics subjects and software engineering. But here's one very quite popular model. It's called the V model because it's a V. And I use it here because I think it's nice and symmetrical and it gives you the essence of what many other life cycles have in different ways. So here are the stages. The idea is that software development goes down the V, you're building stuff, up the V, you're checking stuff and verifying and validating things. And of course you cycle through these. You can have different cycles through these things. And the dotted red line is referring to a description that you've done previously in the cycle. So at the very start, you have some way of specifying what the requirements are. It may be semi-formal, it may be informal, it may be very formal, depending on which branch of the industry you're working in. In some branches of the software industry, it will be mandatory which particular languages you use. For example, if you're working to certain, say, defense standards or something like that, there will be mandatory standards that you may have to use for certain integrity levels. More generally, it may not be mandatory, it might be a question of good practice, whatever organization you're working in. But anyway, you're using some way of capture, but people often talk about capturing requirements, which is a slightly strange notion. It's like you somehow trap them, they're somehow there, and if only you could trap them. That's not quite true. Anybody who's ever done anything remotely like this realizes that it's a very malleable kind of thing. Sometimes you're not quite sure whether you've got them all or whether you understood them correctly, and you cycle many times. It can be very complex. Once that is reasonably stable for whatever part of the cycle you're on, then you might produce an architecture description. So a reasonably complicated piece of software, it has an architecture, it will have major components, it will have perhaps structural components that you can map onto the structure of the software you're building. It may have other ways of describing the architecture that are more functional in nature, to do with the functions it performs, which may not be the same as the structure you're building. So this can get quite complicated. So once you've had the broader architecture picture in place, which again may be formal or semi-formal, then you would typically specify what the software is that you want to build. And again, that can have different levels of formality. If you're interested in building via very high integrity software, that might be the sort of formal specification that you describe in logic, probably not propositional logic, but a logic, or you might describe it using some finite state machine notation. You'd see notations rather similar, a little bit more complicated, a little bit more structured than what you're experiencing just now, but it would still be a similar kind of idea of specification about this level. And then using that specification, you construct the software, hardware, whatever it is for your system. and you're building something to that specification. So that's all building stuff. Build, 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 build. Understanding the problem and building representations that help you to know what it is that you're going to do. And eventually, you do it. That's the thing that's actually going to have the effect on the world. And then what you do is you go back up and check across. So once you've built the software, hardware, then you look at this thing versus the specification of what you said you would build and verify it. Yeah. Have you built it right? And if this is formal, then you might be actually using formal verification tools to actually check it automatically against the specification. More commonly, you'll be doing things that are a mixture of formal and informal, and maybe not conclusive verifications, maybe testing and so on. Once you verify the specification, then you verify the architecture. Are you still preserving the constraints that you set when you did the architectural modeling? Once you verify the architecture, then you validate against the requirements. Have you built the right thing, rather than building the thing right? Okay. And of course, at any one of these points, you might find that you have a problem, at which point then you have to cycle. And that's when it all gets hideously complicated. You have to go back and revisit different bits of the specification or architecture or the requirements. And you can imagine how complex that gets if it's a big project. And one of the reasons why many big projects fail is because the complexity tends to build and build and build at all of these levels, combinatorially with the complexity of the software that you're trying to build. And what makes it worse is that if you have a sequence of stages in this sort of process, where you can inject errors in your software, at any one of the particular stages, then if one of your stages is really bad, it brings down the quality very rapidly of the whole series. And I don't want to get into exactly why that happens, but these sorts of effects are the ones that you typically see, and these are the reasons, well, some of the reasons, why it can be very expensive to build very large software systems, and there is a limit to the scale of the system that you can build. So the reason I'm explaining this is just to give a little bit of background to why you need to have things that are a bit like finite state machine models quite commonly in software design, often at kind of around about this level or around about this level, sometimes other levels. Okay, so it's giving you some point to this exercise. Right, that's all I want to say about life cycle stages. And now I just want to give you an example of specifying something that's a little bit more complex than the things that we've seen so far. So that's really most of what we'll do in this lecture, or possibly this bit of the lecture, if I get onto the other one that I might possibly squeeze in. What I'm going to do is I'm going to give you an example of a specification first. I'm rather relying on people not having prepared too much for this lecture, because I'm going to give you an example first and work through it, and then I'm going to give you another example of something a bit different, and then leave you a bit of time to think about it, a bit like we did in the last lecture, and then work through a standard answer just to get a feel for how you do this sort of thing. That's all we're going to do. Okay, so imagine what you want to build is a specification for a controller for a data projector, like one of these guys up here. This is going to be, of course, normal requirement specifications and so on are more complicated than this, but here's a little bit of a requirement specification. So my controller for my data projector has to be able to control the input from either the computer or the video. So this thing probably has, down underneath here, it's got a something that can do video. It's got a computer here. Currently, it's projecting onto the computer, and I'd like to have a controller that can allow me to switch between them. So when I want to show you some video, I can show you some video. Click. When I want it to come from the computer, as it's currently doing, I can just click it, and it comes from the computer. So that's one requirement. I'd like my controller to do that, please. It should be possible to switch between them while the data projector is operating. I don't want to have to switch the data projector off, change to whatever one it is, and then have to switch it on again. I just want to be able to go click, click, and move between. And the third requirement might be, you could have lots of requirements, I'm giving you three, must be, if I want to switch that thing off, I have to press the power button on my controller twice. So that I can't, I'm working with this thing and one is switching these, I press it by accident and it goes off. I don't want that to happen. I need to have to do it twice so that I can't normally do it by accident. Okay, so these are three requirements that I want to preserve. Okay, I'm going to do is give you the design of this. So I'm just going to give you this. There's some intellectual thing that you have to do as a designer that says, here is the design. And in the real world, you have lots and lots of thinking, but I'm just going to give you a design. So here's your design. It's a transducer, so you can see every arc is labeled with the input slash the output. Remember that? Are you all familiar with that notation? So you know how to read an arc. And a state is just a state of the system. And here's the initial state. So initially, it's off. If I press the power button, then I send the signal. The output is the signal to the controller for the projector saying, switch it on. Okay, so that sends a signal. Remember, I'm designing the control system. I'm not designing the projector, I'm designing the control system. So that's sending an output to the control system to switch it on. And the state is that computer is working and it's switched on. I'm giving you a little mnemonic on this on the state just to give you conceptually where we are in the operation of the system. It's in that state. And then I can press the mode button, which is a little toggle. I have another button on my controller, which is a toggle, that's switching the mode. Press the mode button when it's with the computer feed and on, then it switches to the video feed and on. And as output, it sends a signal to the system to say, switch to video. And I'm assuming then the system does whatever it does as a response to that. Well, what it does is it switches over to the video channel. Then I'm in a different state where the video is is feeding through and the system is on. Then if I press the toggle again, it goes back to the computer. So I can go toggle between the two. Then there's a kind of symmetrical thing that happens here and here. So I'll just do this one. I won't do this one because it's the same type of thing. So this is where I press the power button. It's on. If I press the power button in this state, I press the power button. It sends a suspend signal, and it's in wait mode. After a particular time, it goes back. Okay. If I press the power off again, it goes to off. This is a button I'm pressing on this thing. Same thing happens here, actually. If you remember this kind of notion of structured design, if you were doing this in a kind of structured way, you would probably build one of these first. And then you should build another one like that, which is the same behavior, and then do the connections. That'd be a structured way to do it.
Why do we have to disable the mode button for when
we're in the game? Da, 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 da.
Wait to the mode just does
not. Oh, yes.
That's not necessarily.
So what this is doing is giving you the two power clicks. You have to have another state where you've clicked the power. You're waiting to see whether you're going to click the second button.
Yeah, but if you click the button accidentally, you're going to have to wait 5 or 6 seconds until you're able to press the mode button to switch the mode.
Well, so what this is doing is, say, I press the power button, and now I'm in wait mode. Now, if I press the mode button, then I guess an alternative would be I press the mode button and would take me back to here instead of the other one. I guess that might be a possibility. You could argue that, yeah, possible. But the main point is we do have to have this state, right? We couldn't get rid of the state. Okay, so. More or less, you understand that, right? You could have built one of those. And then you describe the inputs. The reason I'm giving you the inputs in detail is because when the next one comes along, I'm going to give you the inputs and get you to do the design fairly quickly without too much detail. So then here were the inputs. There's the power one. It's the signal from the on-off button on the remote control. The mode button was from the signal from the mode button on the remote control. And then there's a time signal that comes from the system clock. These are inputs to my controller system. And then the outputs, these are just all the labels you've seen on the diagram. They're all of, actually, you can read these. These are the outputs that go to the external system that's controlling the data projector. Right? So normally what would happen, I gave you the design first, and then I gave you the inputs and the outputs. Normally it would be the other way around. You would figure out what the inputs and outputs had to be and then do the design. And maybe cycle back if you needed to re-engineer things with inputs and outputs. Okay? Happy with that. So now the requirements. I nearly forgot. So remember our three requirements. What I'm going to do now is go through each of the three requirements and convince you that the requirements are, at least I hope, convince you that requirements are satisfied by the system design that I've got. First requirement, if you remember, was you had to be able to control the input from either the computer or the video. Okay, and so here's why I believe that to be true. So here's the one where the computer is feeding through and it's on. Here's the one where the video is feeding through and it's on. So those are the two pertinent states. And then from the start state, I can reach both of those. Okay, so that means I can control both of them. I can get from the start state to each one of these states using the controls of my recorder. So that's kind of a simple one. Next one is I have to be able to switch between computer and video while it's in operation. That's another reasonably simple one to demonstrate because here's where it's computer, here's where it's video, and I can show that this toggles using the mode button. I can go here, I can go here while it's in operation without going through the bit where it switches the power off. So that's true. Third one is a little bit more complicated because this says the power button has to be pressed twice to switch off. And it's a little bit more complicated because now I have to show that here's the bit where it's switched off. And what I need to show is the only way that I can reach here is through two consecutive operations of the button. So I need to then traverse the graph back through here. And you can look, here's off. Okay, now so here's power. Here's the power and going off, and I have to find another one just before it here, right? And another one here, and there are no more routes that get me to off, and all of them go through two operations of the power button, therefore that's the only way to go there. So it's a little bit more complicated because that's a universal over the universal, sort of a universal quantifier over the states of the system. Okay, so those are, I just want to give you a feel for the sort of thing that you do. So what we've gone through is, set up some requirements for the system. Remember the life cycle diagram. We set up some requirements for the system, three of them. We had some ideas actually in our own heads, which I didn't write down, just to save time, about what it was that the system had to do. We do a state machine, which, knowing the things we know about the system, we believe was the correct kind of system, and we also wanted to be able to say, oh, and we can look back at the requirements and say we satisfied them. Then we looked at the system, went through it and showed that it satisfied those requirements. Right? That was the process that we've just been through. So now, here's another slightly more complicated system. And what I want to do is to give you the set of requirements, and then I'll give you some inputs and outputs, and then just give you a little bit of time to think about how you design this kind of system. So here are some requirements. I should say what a cruise control system is. Actually, I have to admit, true confession, I never drove anything with a cruise control system. So I have no immediate experience of driving a car with a cruise control system. So a cruise control system in a car is basically a little system where you can drive away, you're driving down the motorway, and you can set the speed to the particular speed that you're driving at, and the car itself maintains that speed as you're driving. It saves you maintaining speed. And then, of course, for safety, you have to be able to accelerate out of that speed, and you have to be able to switch it off and all of those kinds of things. Okay. So I guess most of you know, most of you are possibly more familiar than I am with what a cruise control system is in a car, right? I don't need to explain that anymore, do I? Don't worry if you don't know, signal, because there's no shame in it, but I mean, not knowing that, it's possibly a good thing. But everybody knows what I'm talking about, right? Okay, so here are some requirements for my cruise control system. Now, I'm not giving you the whole description, so actually, when you're doing this yourself, you're just going to have to kind of make up what's a reasonable behavior for it. And when you see them, and I'll show you my version of it, when you see it, you'll probably think of other behaviors that it should have. I'm not too worried that you captured the perfect design for a cruise control system. How could you possibly do that in 5 or 10 minutes sitting in a lecture? This is just a little bit of mental exercise. So here are some requirements. First one is driver has to be able to turn the cruise control system off. You've got to be able to switch the thing off. Otherwise, you're going to be driving at 70 miles an hour somewhere through the town, and that wouldn't be good. Obviously, you have to be able to tell the system to maintain the current speed. Otherwise, it's not cruise control. You have to be able to say, yep, keep it going now. After you brake, you don't want the cruise control to be still operating. Otherwise, braking is not going to be very helpful for you. And this last one is it shouldn't allow the driver to travel faster than the set speed by using the accelerator. Okay. So these are some requirements. You might think of different ones. Okay. So to kind of start you off. If you're being ultra diligent when you're thinking about this, you might want to jot down what these are, because I won't be able to keep both. I'm not technologically literate enough to keep both up on different screens at once. So it might be a good idea to jot them down. So here are the things that the driver can do. Driver can press the on-off button. Driver can set the cruise control to the current speed. The driver can press the brake on the car. Driver can press the accelerator. Driver can release the accelerator. Or it can press the button that says resume going at the speed that I'd previously set. So that's what the driver can do through the various controls that the driver has at their disposal. Then the system is also going to be able to take some input from the larger control system for the car. So one signal is car is at the correct speed. So you can the car is sensing how fast it goes. It knows what you set the speed at. It can know whether you're at the correct speed. Another one is the car is going slower than the set speed. Another one is going faster. So you have something that's monitoring your speed of the car. It can signal back to give you an idea of how fast you're going. Right. Outputs. System can, so this, these are the things that your system is going to be able to tell the engine control system. One is to store the current speed. Another one is to increase the throttle, and the other one is decrease the throttle. So remember what the speed is, go faster, go slower. Those are the three things, right? Okay, so then have a little think for, let's see, how long will we leave it? Maybe just 5 minutes, and I think that might allow me to squeeze in this other lecture, smaller bit, at the end, I think. So think about 5 minutes about how you design that kind of thing. And then I'll just give you an answer and talk a little bit about the requirements. And it's going to be pushing it a little bit for time. Just wondering. I might give you a tiny bit less than 5 minutes. I know this is nowhere near enough time to really think about this problem, but just to get a little bit of thought of your own into the lecture. No. Oh, okay. I suggest not bothering with that because it's going to get too complex. I'm giving you ridiculously little time as it is. I mean, really, just to think a little bit about maybe even designing some bit is fine. Yeah, sorry.
What happens when you press the button?
Oh, ignore that. Just ignore that. Yeah, you got enough to think about. Trust me, you've got enough to think about. I mean, in some ways, I'm pushing you too hard because really I should give you, I mean, if what I was doing was really wanting you to think about this, I'd probably need to give you about 20 minutes to kind of think about exactly how to structure this and so on. That would be a kind of, I would say that would be a reasonable amount of time to think about how to sketch out the bones of this particular state machine. And I'm only going to give you 4 or 5. So you're never really going to make it. I realize this. But I did want you just to think about it. And then I'm just going to give you a bespoke answer, which is not the uniquely best answer. It may contain bits that could be improved, but at least you'll have thought about your answer before I give you that one. Otherwise, it'll just be a picture on the board. Okay, got enough time to think about it a little bit, so... Oh, I forgot to give you the states. Okay, never mind. Okay. So here's my version of this. And you could never, I would be really... If you managed to produce anything remotely resembling this, then actually you must be able to write really fast. So there's no way you could have done all of this. And I think what I suggest you do is you have all the slides... because I do want to kind of speed on and try and fit in this other lecture at the end if I possibly can. Or unless you really want to dwell on this, that's also okay. But I think I prefer just to get... Are we happy for us just to whiz through this bit? Then you look back on it again and check that things like this diagram make sense. Okay. All I'm doing is just sensitizing to the idea of building slightly bigger finite state machines and thinking about their properties. That's all. Okay. You don't need to memorize this thing or anything. So here's the way I thought about it. So here's the state where it's off, and then you switch it on. When you switch it on, it's in a state where it's ready, but nothing really much has happened. So then there are various things that can happen that just keep it in the ready state. But if you set the current speed, then it sends the signal to store that speed in the engine controller's memory. Okay. And at that point, you set the current speed. Then from there are various things that can happen that keep you in that state. But if you press the accelerator, you get to the state where the accelerator has been pressed. And you stay in that state because you're accelerating out of it. And you stay in that state while the accelerator is being pressed. Resume. Why is it staying in that state there? I would have thought it should have gone back to here. Actually, I'm not sure why I put that one in there. Don't know. Then if you brake, it goes in the state where you have braked, and it's waiting. And then if you press resume, you go back to the state where you're setting the speed. Well, actually, these ones, I guess, are worth looking at. So these are the signals coming. Remember, there were signals that come from the engine. If you're going too fast, you send the signal to decrease the speed. If you're at the correct speed, you're just staying at this state. If you're getting a signal that says it's too slow, then you increment the speed. That's what's going on here. So this is the bit where you're trying to maintain the set speed. Then from things like accelerate, if you press the on-off again, it goes to off. Right? So there's lots of little nuances about this diagram, but that's kind of the basics of it I'm trying to go through quickly. So imagine you've got this diagram. Same principle. Now, we're interested. Driver must be able to turn the cruise control system off. So the way to check that is all of the states go to off if somebody presses the on-off. So this is another one of these universal ones. So it doesn't matter which state I'm in, there has to be a transition that has an on-off signal that goes to here, which there is. Okay? Next one, driver has to be able to tell the system to maintain the current speed. So that one, what you want to do is to show that all the states go to set, which is the one where you're trying to maintain the current speed, via a driver command. So if the driver says set, you go to the current speed. If you're in wait, the driver can say resume, you go to the current speed. If you're accelerating, if you type, if you release the accelerator or press set, then you go back to that. Next one is after braking, you don't want the cruise control system to operate. So here we are. What you want to show is that braking never leads directly to the set state. You also have to go through some other intermediate state. So then you look for all the brake inputs. There's the set state, and you can see from the topology you don't. You always have to go through some other step before you go back to the set state after braking. And the last one is that the system has to allow the driver to go faster than set speed using the accelerator. So when you press the accelerator, you go. So that's a rather easier one. So then to get to acceleration from set and from wait, you press the accelerator, then you're in this accelerate state. Okay, and you could think of other properties that you do this way. Okay, so that's it for this one. I think I just have time to do the next one. Are you happy with that? Let's move on. Looking good. Get rid of this one. So this would have been another lecture, but I think my job is not to teach you how to do mathematical proof in any deep sense. That's for mathematics and other things that come later. But there is but I do want to give you an idea of thinking about more abstractly properties of finite state machines. All I want to do is to give you an idea of this. I'm not here to train you to be theorem provers. That's a different topic. So what I want to talk about is a little bit about the limits of finite state systems, what they can do and what they can't do, and how you think about that abstractly. The example I'm going to use is a palindrome. So palindrome is a word, reads the same backwards or forwards. So there's kayak, has a Y in the middle, K-A-Y-A-K, K-A-Y-A-K. I is another one, E-Y-E, E-Y-E. Left or right, it reads the same, it's symmetrical, around the middle. Okay, that's a palindrome. If you have an alphabet, let's take the alphabet A and B, because that's the smallest one that we can reasonably work with. given an alphabet that consists of A and B, then the palindromes in all of the sequences we can get of A and B are A, B, AA, BB, ABA, BAB, all of these, right? So you could imagine, in your mind's eye, you can imagine all of the palindromes that we could construct, some limitless number of palindromes that we could construct from this. Okay, so here's a theorem. There's no finite state machine that can recognize the language of palindromes. Okay. So how would you go about being able to prove that? So I just want to go through that. I'm going to go through that particular one and then just talk to you about a general property of finite state machines that's useful for you to know. It's an example of a limiting property of finite state machines. Okay. And actually, that given the time limitations I have, I think I'll probably stop there. There's another bit, if you have the slides for this particular lecture, there's another bit at the end of that lecture that talks about grammars. And I think I may actually leave that because of the time limitations that we've got. Maybe to a later lecture, I might talk a little bit more about grammars there. So here's the first, the proof is going to go in a couple of stages. So here's the first stage, and this is what we want. This is our theorem, right? Now, this bit, actually, we haven't gone through in the lectures yet. This bit, I'm afraid you will just have to trust me. You go through the bit in the tutorials. So for any finite state machine, non-deterministic, we can translate it into an equivalent deterministic finite state machine. Okay, so you have to believe that. So given that, then what I want to show, this is going to be a proof by contradiction. So I want to show that it's contradictory to believe that there exists a deterministic finite state machine that can recognize palindromes. Okay, if I can show that it's ridiculous to believe that, then you must believe that there that there is no finite state machine that can recognize palindromes, right? So happy with that first step. Proof by contradiction. I'll show you that it's ridiculous to believe that there could exist such a finite state machine. Okay. Okay, so now let's think about what that would look like. So every finite state machine has to have some finite number of states. That's why it's a finite state machine. The states are finite. So here's a palindrome. We have with the A's and the B's and the A's. And suppose we have one where there are K of each of them. So there's K A's, K B's, and K A's. Doesn't matter what K is. It could be two, in which case it would be A A B B A A. Right? But it's whatever K. Right? So AK is the character repeated K times. So then any accepting trace for AK, BK, AK has to look like this guy. So we have an initial state, and then the number of states that would get us the first AK, so that's K plus 1 because we have the initial state, right? The initial state plus the number of states that allow us to chew off the first K A's, right? So that's this bit, that's the first K A's, and then there's the next KBs and the next KAs. So that's three lots of Ks there. So K plus one states for the first AK. That tells us something extremely important because it means there has to be some loop in this bit of the finite state machine, right? We have K is the number of states in our finite state machine, and we're giving it a palindrome that is AK, BK, AK. And so that first AK steps has to have a loop because it's one more than the number of states in our machine. Right? It couldn't be just a straight line finite state machine. Happy with that? Okay, that's K. Finite state machine of size K. It must be finite, so there must be some K. And then I can always invent some palindrome that is AK, BK, AK, because I can have palindromes as long as I want, even with just the alphabet AB. Right? Completely content with that. Good show. Here's the bit where it gets a little bit hairy. Okay, so we have to visit the same state more than once then when we're reading the first that first set of KAs, right? Because there has to be a loop. Must be. Right, for this finite imaginary finite state machine. Okay. And that loop, since it's a loop, it has to have some number of A's in it. That's the J here, right? So there's some loop with some number of steps in it, reading off the A's. So what that means is that if I read A, K, and let's say, if I read A, K minus I, then BK, then AK, gets me to an accept state. In other words, if I look at this, there's the J, there's the I that I get count to get to the bit where I do the loop, and then the other K's there. So that's the distance on that finite state machine between here going straight through to an accept state, right? Gotta be. Because I got a loop. I've got the J is taking out the loop. That leaves the I number of steps here, and I can go from here through to an accept K minus I, BK, AK. That would be the distance in number of steps, right? Got to be true, just because of the topology of the thing, and the fact that I've got a loop. Happy with that one. Okay. But that was the statement. That's my state machine. Remember, I'm saying there's a finite state machine that can recognize all palindromes. So now I've constructed the finite state machine I need for that particular palindrome, but I want it to be able to accept every palindrome, so I'm allowed to give it any other palindrome now that I choose. Otherwise, it would be ridiculous to believe I could have this machine. So let's take this machine, and let's say I give it something that's not a palindrome now, okay? Because which I would want it to reject, right? It's not a palindrome. I want it to reject this one, and the one I'm going to give it is a k plus I. That's the I in here. So I'm going to add on to the front exactly the number of steps I need. Okay? Which I'm allowed to do because what this finite state machine has to do is to reject the ones that aren't palindromes, accept the ones that are. Okay, so I give it that one, which is definitely not a palindrome because it's got I added to the front. So it's going to read IAs to get to this state, which is the one where the loop is, leaving this. And then we're going to do the looping, and it's going to leave this. But the trouble is that from A, K minus I, B, K, A, K, reaches an accept state.
Shouldn't there be, after it reads the I, A, it should leave A, K, B, K, A, K, and then reads J, A, leaves A, K minus J, B, K, A, K?
No, what you're doing here is you're deliberately giving it something. What's really happening here is what you're doing is you're deliberately giving something that pushes your finite state machine to exactly the point where in the previous palindrome it would be doing the right thing because it had got the I, right? And it was exactly the state where it's going to have to move on and do the rest. But you're giving it a new one which pushes it to precisely the same state, but it's already seen exactly that number of A's. That is the trick that's being done, actually. So, I mean, there's a little bit of jiggery pokery with numbers, but that is the trick.
What I meant is that if you feed it k plus i a's and it reads I of them, it should leave only k a's.
But what you're doing is you're giving an extra I, whatever that is, and that's exactly the I that takes you to the state where your finite state machine thinks it's got through, right, and done your palindrome, and then you've got the loop that will chew off whatever is remaining. Fine, it will do that for you. And then off you go, as if nothing bad had happened. But in fact, something very bad did happen. You extended it on the left-hand side. And the reason why your finite state machine can't recognize this is because it has no memory of how many times it's going to have to go through there. Right? Okay, so this is the conclusion. So the thing to do if you find that a little bit counterintuitive, which it's not counterintuitive, but it just takes a little bit of time to work through it, then what that shows is that if you have a finite state machine that will correctly accept a palindrome, but then it must also incorrectly accept the palindrome with some I attached, something stuck on the end that deceives it into thinking that actually at that particular state where it has to make a jump, it's dealing with something that was in the right form before it hit the jump. Right? That's the bit where you can fool the finite state machine. Yes. But since I've shown you it for any, you choose any k. That will work for any k. Right. So if that's true, then it's ridiculous to believe that you could have a finite state machine that will recognize a single finite state machine that will recognize every palindrome. You cannot construct it because I can always assemble you a palindrome which will break the machine. That's the point. That's the universe. That's the always bit. Any k you choose, I can show you a palindrome that will break it. I can give you any k. I give you an I. Okay. So it doesn't matter. Actually, it doesn't matter to me. Sort of it matters. In some intellectual sense, it matters to me that was compelling for you. But if it wasn't, it's not the end of the world, because here's a general rule of thumb for you, which I think is much easier to remember. Finite state machines can't count up to arbitrarily high numbers is a good one useful thing to remember. And the reason why is a fundamental, because of a fundamental property of finite state machines. They have no memory on the nodes. Why am I telling you this? Because lots of other notations that you will get later on when you're doing more complicated things will have these extra things, like bits of memory on the nodes, or ways of transferring information through the finite state machine and so on. That's what makes them more complicated than the ones that you've seen. That's a kind of simple thing to remember. Why can't they count? Because in a finite state machine, the only thing that you can do that resembles counting is moving between the states. Each state can't remember it. It's just there. It's just a local state. The only thing the state tells you is where you can go from where you currently are. That's the only piece of information you have on a state with the notation I've given you. And if you want to do something that involves more complex processes, you need to have a more elaborate model of what the computation is than the one that I've currently given you. I won't go on to the context-free grammar because we're just up to time. So I nearly squeezed in the rest of that, but not quite. I hope that wasn't too fast. I don't think it was.